He's going to come in again with an unexpired term. I don't know exactly for how long that is. I don't think it's too long, though. So that's maybe going to be an issue at some point, but maybe not. But Powell's got another 2 years left, I believe. Do we have Professor Kevin?
You do. You do. Let me mute and cough for a second.
All right. So this guy, Mirren, voted no on every decision since he's been there. He's kind of a Trump guy and voted for lower rates the whole way, which is about as ignorant as it gets with the inflation the way it is. But he did that. That's what he was put there to do, and that's what he did. So it's, you know, sometimes you got to do what you're told, I guess, even when you're in that kind of a position. But anyway, he's going to make room for Kevin Warsh as soon as when the new guy takes his seat, or I would say a couple minutes before he takes his seat. So there'll be a seat there for him.
Yeah, that's actually like today, isn't it?
I'm not sure when he takes it. Doesn't say. He's filling in the unexpired term of Adriana Kugler, who abruptly resigned in August of 2025. He was on the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. I don't know if he's going to go back to that or what. And so we'll see where it goes. Keeping the Federal Reserve to its narrow mandate and out of hot button political and cultural issues.
Well,
interesting. So there. I don't know how.
All right, happy days are here.
Yeah, have you ever seen the Fed being actually independent, Kevin? I mean, it's got to be the most political spot in Washington.
Well, no, it might have been independent somewhere in our lifetimes.
When?
Probably pre-memory.
Yeah, somewhere. Anyway, so we got that going for us. We also got the market down today after being up a few days. Of course, you're hitting nothing but mixed reviews on the trip to China, depending on who you listen to, so you never really know what the truth on that is.
I don't see a lot of concrete out of it. But that doesn't mean there isn't. It just means that we haven't seen it yet. So,
well, one thing that was somewhat...
I think if they do get the Chinese to buy U.S. oil, that will probably be substantial. Promises versus what really happens when it comes to the Chinese. I don't know that they would be in a pretty good contest with the Iranians about keeping some of those promises. So
I'm not so sure we're so good on that these days either, but. What exactly, where would your read be on the oil situation? I go through the numbers, but as much as I can make it, we're pretty much dead even on what we produce and what we use here. Where is this all coming, where's all the stuff for sale coming from exactly?
That would be very hard for me to say, since I'm not an oil industry expert. So you probably need to get somebody who knows the oil industry.
If we're going to sell stuff from here, it means we're going to constrict the supply here a little bit, which means prices are going to go up here.
It does, and that would tap into it. If we do get Iran resolved, there should be a flood of oil, at least to some extent, that will find its way onto the market, and it'll have an impact. I don't know what impact, for how long the impact. That is for people who are much, much more tapped into this than I am. But I don't know how that's going to shake out in terms of the distribution. I also don't know if we say buy oil from the U.S., are we talking about oil that's pumped out of the ground in the U.S.? Are we talking about oil that's refined in the U.S.? So I would start asking a bunch of questions like that, too.
Well, before this all started, my understanding is that the world was slightly awash in oil. Not totally overproductive, but at $60-$65 a barrel, it was pretty much at equilibrium there, which is enough for people to make money and at a price where most countries seem to be able to live. At 100, some people are making a real lot of money, and other people are not doing so hot, and a lot of people don't have it at all. They have some, Japan and other places. And I think, Kevin, last time I checked, there's like 15, 20 places that export oil. Well, it's not just OPEC's down to like, I don't know, 12, 13% or something. You got places like Libya, you got Venezuela seemingly doing a little better. They were down a lot from where their peak. But you have no idea, and the stuff with the China thing, I mean, Boeing supposedly, of course, when somebody blabs that there's 200 planes they're buying, is that a contract? Is it a signed deal? I mean, are the prices? I mean, who the hell knows? But whatever reason, people, whoever the hell people are, must have thought that Boeing was going to get more than that. Now, how, because the stock was down as much yesterday as it was up 2 days before in anticipation of the trip. So I don't know, what did people think? The number was 300 or 400? How many planes does China buy a year? I mean, they don't make any of their own, do they? Is it just Airbus? Well, there's the guys from Brazil that make planes.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of small producers out there in the world, but as far as I don't know anything about the Chinese aerospace industry, so I don't know what to tell you. Are they focused on on rockets? Are they focused on space? Are they focused on all of the above? That's a good question. Don't know. Probably could do a little research. It wouldn't be hard to find out.
Well, I think we've talked on the show before that when they were going to buy a bunch of the 787s when they were new, which wasn't that long ago. Part of the deal was they were going to make, I think they were going to make the tail section, Kevin. And remember people were bitching and moaning because they demanded the drawings for the whole plane or something. Remember that whole story? Mm-hmm. Which, I think if you're an engineer and you're building a piece of the thing, you sort of would want to know how it meshes in with the rest of the stuff as to why you need to know, how...
You mean the tail should actually attach to the airplane?
Yeah, imagine that. But I don't think that they have the capability with that. They probably could build one of the ones with aluminum. But I don't know if they have the capability of doing the manufacturing process of that carbon fiber stuff. Boy, that's pretty sophisticated. I mean, having the drawings and getting the thing done. I give you a stack of drawings of a railroad car. It doesn't mean you're actually pulling one out the end of the factory. Right? There's a lot between the drawings and the car. And an airplane's got to be, 1,000 times more complicated. So, you just...
As far as all of it goes, the balance that we have to strike, first of all, nobody wants to ignore that market. It's too big to not, for nobody to sell in it. So we have to be able to sell in the market. And they're going to, they will always have demands about what's produced there, just like we're doing now. I mean, it's no different than we're doing. We're saying if you want access to our markets, you're going to have to invest more in manufacturing in the U.S. And we've been doing that so that, I'm not knocking it as policy, but it's almost like we have to work with these people, and yet we have to recognize that they're adversaries as well. And I think you see that with with a lot of the policies, a lot of things where we've been getting involved with with the various choke points around the world and trying to strike deals with different countries that allow the U.S. to have much more of a presence there. All of that is going on because they want to clip China's wings, but we can't just kill China, nor would we be able to kill China reasonably. So, I think there's a strange balance that we're trying to strike here, and we'll see how it works out.
Well, there's a couple things here that kind of are really odd to me. Is, let's say, whoever we have in charge that we elect is trying to strike the balance that you're talking about, which I will say that, let's say all of our guys, right or wrong, have at least tried to do that. Who the hell knows if one did or didn't. But you can't assume. I mean, if Trump was Solomon and was really trying to do exactly what you said, which is pretty damn hard to do, I don't know that the people he brought with have anywhere near the same theme, do you? I mean, some do. Some are, I think, America firsters, whatever that means. Others, they don't give a crap. Do you think the guy from NVIDIA cares about America?
Well, yeah. And I think that's one of the, you know, when you talk about having to thread a needle, that's one of the things that you have to do, because you have people who on the one hand, have their own interests, and on the other, should have the country's interest, at least to some degree. But when you're an international business, when that's all you do is do business all over the world, you know, how localized are your loyalties going to be? I think just as a natural point of view, I don't think you're going to see a lot of that. So you have to find out where your interests converge, and we'll see. We'll see. I'm skeptical of anything as it relates to dealing with the Chinese, and I'm sure they feel the same way about us. I'm sure. Same thing with dealing with the Russians and, frankly, dealing with a lot of other significant players in the international business world.
The thing that has me very, very concerned about the two people that are in charge here, meaning Trump and Xi, and it's not a personal thing. Both countries, based on their policy and others, are flat-ass broke. That's a problem. That's a serious problem. I mean, China has nothing but economic problems. And so do we. And ours continue to be buffered by people outside this country who buy into our stuff, that finance our place, finance our spending. And for some reason, this administration doesn't seem to I don't know if any of them ever realized that. They just thought it was always going to be there. And now it's, I think it's kind of wobbling. And I think China's got the same problems. I think they're broke. So when two guys are kind of getting together, I'll use the term somewhat desperate, I get real nervous. I mean, maybe it's because I'm too close to numbers, Kevin, but both of these guys have to realize that their countries are in deep doo-doo debt-wise. I mean, is this guy going to have people over there paying mortgages for places they're never going to move into for the rest of their lives? I mean, what are they doing? that's why they're looking at Taiwan. Taiwan's got nothing but money, right? They want it. Why are we looking at Greenland and Cuba? They got it. We want it. Let's take it. I mean, we're both doing the same damn thing. How do they even have the same kind of... How do you tell a guy you shouldn't have any sights on Taiwan when we're starving the hell out of the Cubans and we tell people we want to take over Greenland? What kind of moral... What moral high ground do we have, or does anybody have these days? I mean, it just seems like... What a conversation. Why even bother? Just saying. I mean,
it's a giant game of risk.
Yeah, it's a giant game of something. And then, I cannot figure this guy Z out. I mean, obviously, I've never met the man, but you and I have talked on a few occasions. One of the most fascinating books I've ever read was George Marshall, Soldier and Statesman. And everybody knows about, people should know that he was the head of the Joint Chiefs during the World War, whatever that. He was a major general, the man in charge of World War II. But he stayed here because he was charged two front war. He was a logistics genius, all that kind of crap. And then he went on to the Marshall Plan in Europe. Well, in the middle there, he had the most god awful job. Literally, when he was driving home, he resigned after the war. He drove home, and his wife pulled into the driveway, and the phone was ringing. It was Truman. Hey, you got to get back here. I got to send you over to China to try and resolve this thing between Mao and Chiang Kai-shek. So he and his wife, I think they were there at the end, 6 months, a year, Kevin. It was brutal. Finally wrote a letter to Truman. He goes, you got to get me out of here. I'm doing nothing. These guys are idiots. And the wife couldn't stand it. He never met two people that were more screwed up than Chiang Kai-shek and Mao. They didn't give a crap how many people died. They didn't give. They were just. He goes, he never even met anybody like that. Not even even the Japanese and the Nazis weren't like that. In terms of, we're gonna lose 50,000 guys in this battle today. Who cares? I mean, he got the hell out of there. Now, is Z the same way? Is he somewhat evolved? I mean, I have no idea.
I don't think he's evolved at all. He's actually an interesting history, because his father was started out as part of the I don't know if I want to say regime or what, but part of Mao's inner circle. Then, after making some criticisms, became ostracized, punished, exiled, and so on. And so Xi was affected by that. And so for a long time, he would have been a likely candidate to oppose Mao and to oppose the Communist Party. But as he has grown up and become an adult and gotten in his political progression as an adult, has been every bit as in its own way, every bit the authoritarian and the cold-blooded, authoritarian, the guy who just keeps the population under his thumb to the extent that he can. He's been every bit of what Mao was. So, he's got a strange history to him, and that history is, you would think, would make him a little softer in terms of his approach with the Chinese people, but it's the other way.
Yeah, once you're in charge, you kind of... Well, for those... I don't think we have anybody who listens that don't know this. When the thing finally was, I'll use the term, resolved, Chiang Kai-shek and his group of merry men basically fled to what was then Formosa, which is now Taiwan, right? So that's another part of the issue between the two of them, that was the rebel state kind of from day one back then, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so... But they
so they're very much focused on reunification, as they call it. In other words, taking it over.
Enslavement, taking it over, reunification, whatever you want to call it, right?
That's how they refer to it.
Yeah,
it's always been China. It still should be China.
We had a group of people that were associated with us, used to work for the Department of Agriculture. And we had all these back and forth. They'd had all these back and forth. I'll get this right eventually. We, the U.S. of A., used to have a lot of back-and-forth agricultural dealings with Chinese. And some of our people went over there. I mean, I never did, but these people did. And they had a group that came over here, and there was like 8 or 9 of them. And they used our office as a training ground. And really, we were just starting the show, so it had to be 12, 15 years ago. Kevin, they did... I don't know, they got the budget from the agriculture department. They did everything for these people. I mean, we took them out. I was getting tired of talking to them, to be honest with you. But there were a couple there that were nice, and these were guys that were, one kid, everybody in his family had been a doctor. And now he was a pal. The family damn near disowned him for not being a doctor. Well, a couple of the ladies who were running it were exceptionally attractive. I mean, and one of them said when she was 18, she got on a train and wherever she was, way the hell in western China in some little town, and took a train to Beijing, and 6 years later she was kind of a big shot in the... But everybody's sort of in the party as well. And you could just tell, Kevin, they're kind of... I don't know if they're different than the people in Washington, but all they're trying to do is... We, this group, took them on a barge tour of the Illinois River. Boy, that was pretty cool, because I got to go on that. Took them to see an ethanol plant. And they were so pissed off when the guy at the ethanol plant said, no, everybody's got to leave their phones here and nobody's taking any pictures. Well, that went over like a fart in church. But then they came back here. This guy, Chris, who used to be on the show, goes to the men's room and he's teaching a class in like crop insurance and those kinds of things, which we do in this country that they have no idea what it is. I mean, we do a lot of stuff here that... pretty impressive, even though people say government doesn't do anything. They mean they do. We do stuff that's a lot very impressive. And Dan was talking about, he gave a little speech on, there was a program and the agriculture department was helping farmers, instead of shorting their corn or soybeans, being able to buy put insurance. So if the price went down, you were kind of covered. And when the price went up, you got the price going up. So he goes to the bathroom. One guy runs up and jams a thumb drive in his computer, stealing everything out of the computer. So Chris comes out and he goes, "What are you doing?" He goes, "Well, I'm just." He goes, "We don't do that here. It's not stuff you do. You don't just run up and shove something in somebody's computer and download all this stuff." And the guy's like, "Oh, what do you mean?" It's kind of different. And when you do, and Chris and Carrie, his wife, did work business for a lot of these people buying spot soybeans. And he said the difference between, like, the Chinese and the Thai and the Vietnamese, if the Chinese bought soybeans and it's on the water going over there in a container and the price goes down, they don't want it. I mean, I'm talking about the entire country's a crook, but because they would just renege on the deal. That's why I said it is this thing with Boeing. Did they give them a deposit? But he said the Thai would never do that. The people in Thailand, the Vietnamese would never do that. Koreans would never do that. But the Chinese do it all the time. It's
and to what extent is that? You know, does that apply to what their laws are? To what extent does that apply to culture? I don't know, but. You know, if you're gonna do business with them, you damn well better know.
Yeah, I just wonder what these kind of.
You know, I think where we are now is, and this is probably the both sides' perspective, is sort of like, Michael Corleone telling Pantangeli, I want him, talking about Hyman Roth. He says, "I want Roth totally comfortable in our relationship," even though, because he says. He's a snake. He's all of those kinds of things. And Michael says, "Yeah, but I have business I need to do with him, and I need him comfortable in our relationship. I know exactly who he is." And of course, you may recall Michael tried to have him killed, but that didn't work out. So he finally got him in the end. But that's
as long as you get him in the end.
The whole Cuban Revolution at the time.
Yeah, but if I'm Boeing, I don't even know what the deal would have to look like with those guys. I mean,
I hear you, and so it's there's a real challenge to do it, and yet as a matter of if I were operating a company and I had an opportunity to do business in the Chinese market, it's huge, and I don't think we don't necessarily want to constrain businesses from doing business in China. We're not going to get to that point. Nor would any business that had the opportunity to be in that market accept that. But then, you also have a balance that you would hope is struck about the willingness to, stand up for your home country. But I don't think that's really all that baked in to it, I draw the line in some places. I can certainly forgive a company like Coca-Cola for wanting to sell Coca-Cola in China, but to that many hundred million people. By the same token, I cannot forgive them being an official sponsor of the Beijing Olympics a few years ago, which was totally a showcase for the Chinese Communist Party, that's a bridge too far, and that's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Yep.
Is where do you draw your lines? And as far as I'm concerned, the ethical line should not be endorsing an oppressive political party, in the way that they did. But the line, but would I say, you can't have access to that market. You can't go do business in that market. Of course not. That's probably half of their business.
Well, when Jan and I were on the Score a long time ago, one of our actually debates that we got a bunch of phone calls in. In those days, we used to take phone calls, and we were talking about the China situation. And Jan always set the thing up. He was the host. I said, "John, it's one of the most difficult decisions. If you and I were sitting in the Oval Office and Bill Gates walked in and he goes, 'Hey, these bleeps have 9 zillion computers and they've bought, 5 things of software. It looks to me like that they're duplicating all my stuff.' I mean, obviously, how many Beatles albums did they sell over there without paying a nickel of, whatever the copyright laws, whatever it is?" And so you sit there and go, "God, these Chinese are a bunch of bastards." And all of a sudden he leaves, and we're sitting there trying to figure out how we're going to screw him. And all of a sudden the guy from Kentucky Fried Chicken or from Pepsi walks in and goes, "Hey, whoa, whoa, whoa. Do you have any idea if 100 million people every day have a Pepsi, how that helps me out?" I mean, it's very, very difficult to draw any kind of real... I mean, it's okay for you to draw yours or mine to draw mine, but I mean, very little that you sell anybody can't be used militarily, right? Hell, we export them cotton. You can make uniforms. I don't really make uniforms out of cotton, but you could. And everything you do is somewhat, if somebody wants to use it against you, they pretty much can, right? I mean, who's to say that a chip can only go in a washing machine, but can't go in a rifle scope if a rifle scope has this chip? How do you do that? I mean, you sort of don't. How could you? But I mean, how a government were to draw the line, when clearly everybody here wants to sell anything there, and they don't care if it's militarily available or not. I mean, I don't know that the cockpit in a, maybe the cockpit in a 787 is that much different than in a bomber. I don't know. I mean, I don't know much about it. It's a Lou question, but it's pretty hard to draw those kinds of lines. Yet, they seem to be. I guess I don't know what the country is big enough. There's all kinds of allies around them. I don't know what they really think they need to do militarily. I mean, what do they think they're missing? Is it oil? What is it? We don't really need to do anything here, even though we're doing it. I mean, I don't see any reason why all of a sudden we need Cuba or Greenland, as long as we have some kind of relationship with them. Yet some people here seem to think we do.
I think we wound up striking a deal with Greenland to have a more presence there, didn't we?
No, Trump said last week.
It's a couple of months.
Well, if you think the recent ramblings are just ramblings, last week he said, "Oh, it's really still ours." I mean, the guys over there said, "If you want another base, just tell us. You're the ones that abandoned four bases or whatever it was. If you want to reopen them, reopen them." But I don't know. I don't know where that lands. It stands in the middle of all this other stuff.
Yeah, well, I've sort of gotten used to the idea that Trump's one of these guys who opens with the most ridiculous bluster. Hey, ask Audrey about him. People bidding on houses how often you get these people. I know my mom, who was also a realtor, hated it because, you might have a house listed for $400,000. People come in and say, "I'll offer you $250,000 for it." And they'd end up buying the house, but not for $250,000. But it was leading with the most ridiculously low offer, in hopes of getting something in between there. And I'm kind of used to the idea that that's how Trump does it. He starts with the most ridiculous position on it, and he'll come off of it.
Well, I think what your mom was seeing is somewhat of a difference between the north and the south side. South side,
or the north and the south side are over here in Michigan, where I live. Because, especially when I bought and sold a home in St. Joseph, it was listed. You're going to get list price or something really close to it, but if you're too high, don't worry, nobody's going to bid on it. You're not right. Even going to get an offer, not a low offer, not any kind of offer. And that, that was just the way it was, and that was your message to lower your price, and you lower your price, get it to something reasonable, and all of a sudden the offer is going to come along, and you're going to sell your house. That is their way, but that's not the North Shore of Chicago, Chicago. And, that was just the way it was. But there, a lot of people negotiate that way. So, having been around that for so long in my life, especially, when I was young and lived at home and would hear all these stories, I sort of understood what it was all about. And that's why when I see it now, I say, "Oh, God, I know what he's doing."
Well, some people, if they think it's worth $300,000, will list it at $400,000, and then in some areas the guy will come in with a $200,000 bid, and then you settle at $300,000. And that's sort of a style.
And it's not one that I get it. I just don't like it. It's not how I would want to be negotiating every damn deal that I had to work on in business.
Well, now when a house becomes available, they list it for $400,000. the first three bids are 410, 420, and 430.
Yeah,
so
it's
kind of gotten a little bit sort of bizarre there. So, hey, it's kind of an interesting weekend sports-wise with the Sox winning five in a row. And I mean, baseball is such a fascinating sport. I never dreamed out of all the games the Cubs have, well, they lost a few in a row. I didn't think they were going to beat Chris Sale, but they did last night. This guy Ben Brown's been a savior for him, hasn't he?
Yeah, I had pretty much given up on Ben Brown as a reasonable prospect for the Cubs. You know, through last year, I always figured the guy would get, as soon as he got under pressure, he would cave in. But man, he has been good this year and good in pressure situations. Maybe it just took him a while. It took him a while and took him to become more than a two-pitch pitcher to be able to do that. And as he's developed additional pitches, he's been outstanding.
Yeah, I think that was the thing. He got confidence in a third pitch, and it's made really quite the difference. What do you make of, I know everybody wants to everybody's going throwing the ball 100 miles an hour, but you know the thing you never see, Kevin, is the phenomenon of the radar gun. And we went through this one day. I think I went through it with you, or maybe I went through it with Lou. I got this thing from Quora, and some guy, of course, is an expert on radar guns. Everybody's an expert on something. So by now, they're capable of timing the speed of the pitch when it leaves the pitcher's hand. And 10, 15 years ago, it was like halfway to home plate. And way back, it was like when it crossed the plate. And I didn't realize that the pitch degrades 6 miles an hour between the pitcher's mound and the home plate. So the 100-mile-an-hour fastball, pretty damn fast, equates to like a 93-mile-an-hour fastball, 15 years ago, and probably a 96 a few years ago. Just because of where the radar gun is capable of picking the speed up. Which, if it's true, I guess it, the story that everybody's just bigger and stronger, which they could very well be, they are, but not to the extent that it seems. That if somebody was throwing Greg Maddux's era, he's throwing like 89, and now everybody's throwing 100. I don't think that they're throwing 11 miles an hour faster than Greg Maddux. I mean, the guy's a Hall of Famer, but they probably were doing 4 or 5, but not 11. You know what I'm saying? And how fast were, was Nolan Ryan and those other guys really heaving it? They might have been 102. I'm not saying everybody, but
I would also say that how the pitch degrades is probably a factor of strength too. So if you're stronger, then it's going to maintain. It's sort of like when you swing a bat and the bat hits the ball, there's a certain amount of recoil in there. And the stronger you are, the less your bat recoils, and therefore the harder you hit the ball. You can see that with the slow-mo camera.
I think if you still have your high school physics books, once it leaves your hand, it's pretty much on its own. It's like what's the theory when you fire a shell, once it leaves the end of the gun, it's on its own, right? There's no more propellant. But, some guys, I think a lot of it has to do with, can you imagine if the guys today, assuming they are bigger and stronger, which I think through the league they are, plus you decide you always have a guy with a fresh arm in there, so guys don't have to pace themselves like maybe they did, or maybe they should now with all the guys having surgery. What do you think would happen if they move the mound back up to 6 inches. Everybody forgets that one, too. Before Bob Gibson's huge year, what was the mound was 6 inches?
Don Drysdale's fault, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I got to believe that some of those big monsters that were pitching back then, 'cause there's always been big guys, boy, that had to be like it was coming from Mount Olympus. And everybody forgets that part, too. So, I mean, I don't know how much advantage that would give you, but I can't imagine putting some of these guys today. Imagine putting, who's the guy that the Cubs had for a while, he's going from team to team, the reliever. The guy throws the ball 102. Can you imagine putting that guy on a mound 6 inches higher? For good Lord.
That would be fun.
not for you batting, but...
That would be unhittable.
I got to believe there's going to be a big crowd tonight at Sox Park. With them winning five in a row and they're 500.
Yeah. Well, they're great. In fact, my son is a gigantic Sox fan, you know, he's always tapped into everything going on with the Sox. So I just texted him the other day, just the number .500 when they hit 500. He says he's still that. He doesn't think they're you know, all that good a team, but they're in such a crap league and a crap division that that they're doing really well, and yet, you know, we both agree they're still fun to watch.
But their run production versus give up is dramatically different than the last 2 years.
Oh, sure. I mean, they were losing, you know, 120 and 105 games or whatever it was. So,
well, they got three, four.
I would hope so.
But I mean, they have 3-4 guys now that every other team would covet. I mean, nobody wouldn't want that shortstop.
Another wave of talent on the way.
Yeah, and I, what is the? I know I'm jumping you on this, but sometimes you always surprise me with knowing the answer. When you bid for like that first baseman, last week we talked about, you said a lot of teams have first baseman, but when you bid for the guy, you bid the team, right? Because he's under contract somewhere else. Is that how, or do you wait till they don't have a contract, or what do you do?
Yeah, you sort of bid the team. You certainly have to. You have to pay. That you have to pay the team to get them out of the contract, but you're not, you know, it's up to the player in terms of what, you know, what he's going to accept and where he's going to accept it. And I think in Mune's case, he struck out so much that I don't think he hit a lot of home runs, but, you know, people didn't know if they were getting Adam Dunn or, you know, or were they getting better than that. In terms of you know, how good he was going to be, and I think he's turned out to be better so far. But one of the things, he did make changes from when he was playing in Japan. He's much more selective hitter now. He's taking a lot more walks. He's willing, you know, he's not swinging a crab, and he was before. And when and that's made a huge difference. And I think the Sox now are going to be in a position where they will probably try to extend him if they can, rather than let him go for 2 years and become a free agent.
Well, it's kind of a, when you talk about how the, I don't want to get into it, we've done a million times about the draft and all those other sort of things, but I think that these teams, and there's got to be, God, there's got to be like 4 or 5 of them around Chicago area now, Kevin, that are these smaller teams. Well, the Joliet Jackhammers that just played at the old jail. Bill Murray's part owner of that place. They're one of the teams, and I think they're in a different league for some reason. Is the guys in Crestwood are in with the, you know, Mississippi Mudcats and a couple other people. Then there's the guy, the Rail Cats in Gary. There's like 2 or 3 teams. Then the guys up in Schaumburg. There's a team up there too, right?
I know what you're talking about. I don't know.
I don't think they're in the same league as. No, their league goes north. They're in like what, Iowa and Minnesota or something. So they're actually like.
They have a really cool name for that league that goes north, too. It's called the Northern League.
Really? Well, duh. But I mean, some of the teams that are in with the Crestwood guys and with the Mississippi guys are the Mud. They were not the Mud Hen, something else. Mud something something. But I mean.
Toledo's got the Mud Hens.
Yeah, they're the Mud Hens. And I think if somebody tries out there, you and I go there and we play, and all of a sudden, you know, matter of fact, I went one night in Crestwood, and the guy pitched, on their gun, where who knows how good the gun was, he was 90, 89, 90, 91, and he went 7 scoreless innings, and the guy looked pretty damn good. A nice pickoff move. I mean, he looked like, you know, he pitched before, college, someplace. I go to look his name up on Monday. He was already signed. He wasn't there. So they, I think you have to, now that guy pays, I don't know how much you have to pay the guy from Crestwood to snag his player, if you're the Cubs or the Sox, but I think you have to pay him something. I mean, the guy gives him some kind of coaching, and he did the tryout and all that other stuff. So it must be sort of the same principle getting somebody out of Japan. What you think? I mean, you got to satisfy both the player and the guy who's the team he's under contract with, would be my guess.
I actually think there's a fixed posting fee that is what they call it.
But now Ichiro, they just waited till he was a total free agent, right? I think that was a long time ago.
I don't remember the signing particulars, because you're right, it was a long time ago.
Well, you know, I never got to see that guy play. I mean, I never went to a Sox game when they were here, and I don't think I ever saw them on TV except like an All-Star game or something. I kind of miss that. I mean, but now if you want to see somebody play with everybody getting to play everybody during the year, it actually makes it a lot nicer. I mean, in Chicago, we always had the advantage that if you were a Sox fan and want to see Willie Mays play, you could go to a Cub game. But, I mean, if you were in, how would you like being in Cleveland and never get to see Clemente or Willie Mays or any of those guys? I mean, I don't think it was kind of weird. I actually like the interleague play, and some people are bored by it, but I'm sort of not. So what do you make of...
Before you get away from that, you mentioned Greg Maddux. We had first Maddux of the year. Do you know what a Maddux is?
I should know, but I don't.
It is a complete game shutout in under 100 pitches, named after Greg Maddux.
Wow.
And Bailey Ober of the Twins, just this last week, threw a complete game shutout and only had 89 pitches.
I bet Fergie had a bunch of those.
Yeah, don't know. You can't be a big strikeout pitcher and pull it off. Unless you're just striking out a lot of people on three pitches. So it wasn't that Greg Maddux never struck people out, but he would a lot of people would hit the ball. I don't think he didn't ring up 250 strikeouts a year. And because that just takes extra pitches. You want to get some guys out with one or two pitches if you're going to throw a complete game in under 100. So
when you go back to baseball stats, and of course, there's been box scores and all that stuff forever. I'm thinking, Kevin, even if you went back into the 40s, you would know that, Stan Musial got a hit on a 2-2 pitch. I think probably you've got or struck out and what the count was. I'm guessing there is that kind of statistics, but if this count was 3-2 in 1954 and you fouled three off in a row and then struck out, are the three you fouled off, were they lobbed in the pitch count somewhere? When did the pitch count even start?
Yeah, they go in the pitch count.
But when? But no, I never knew what a pitch count was 30 years ago. Did you? I mean, you knew what it was, but I mean, I never heard anybody say anything about it.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what the average pitch count was, because especially in the era when so many people threw complete games or so many people got really late in the game. I would love, and I'm sure that data is available someplace if I were willing to sit down and work on the, work on the project. But I'm curious, but I'm not curious enough to do the work. How's that?
Well, I know they used to have one of the jobs of a starting pitcher, and this I don't think this was a National or American League box score piece. One of the jobs of the pitcher was to actually go sit in the stands behind home plate.
Yeah, chart the game.
And chart the game. Where they would, the opposing pitcher, they would say, okay, strike two, we threw a curveball low or something like that. So those guys, somewhere buried in somebody's archives, would be a pitch count if you want to go back and find it. But I don't think it's anything you could get by computer. Somebody would actually have to go through all this stuff and find out, this game in 1951, let's dig out the yellowed pages of the guy charting the pitches and hoping it wasn't raining and find out how many pitches the guy actually threw. I mean, I don't think it would be an easy process, but people do it. I mean, obviously people love the stuff. It's what kind of why baseball is such an amazing game, and that the stats, you can argue about whether one era versus another, the stats matter, but they're there, right? I mean, it's interesting. I think I got the number right. I might. One of the most interesting trivia counts was, Kerry Wood, who had probably one of the best careers going ever, and then got hurt. And what was the thing? How many pitches did Kerry Wood throw on the day he got drafted? Now you might say, where did you get that one? Well, he was pitching for his high school team that day, and they had a doubleheader, and I think he pitched the first game, which was it seven innings in high school? And came back and threw two or three innings of relief in the second game. It was like 140, Kevin.
Which is absolutely abusive. You know,
yeah.
No coach should allow that. Even if the player is saying, "Oh, coach, put me in. I want to pitch." Somebody's got to be a grown up and say, "This is not good for you." And you had, you know, I remember in the day, and I know there's summer league circuits and so on, you know, still exist. But in, you know, I remember when in our high school years, the high schools had summer leagues, and then a lot of kids played American Legion, and then they might play, you know, a Colt League game or something like that too. So you had a lot of these guys that were on multiple teams, and they never coordinated who was, you know, who had you pitching, when did they have you pitching, which was just not good for the players.
Well, I think they do.
I would imagine, because I remember some guys that that I played against. And I played against a couple of guys, or with one and against one. I actually probably played against the guy coming up, but with Scott Sanderson.
Now, remember him?
Actually, you know, I probably never did hit against him, but with Scott Sanderson, who pitched for several teams, but quite a few years with the Cubs, and against Charlie Liebrandt, who, if I had been able to hit a curve, might have been a teammate in high school, but you know, I wasn't good enough to make the high school team. And but in the summer leagues, I played against him. And you know, these guys were really nice pitchers, but they were surprisingly not the dominant pitchers in the age group. There were other guys who could throw the ball harder, who just were amazing specimen, and I never heard from them again after we all went off to college. I suspect that in some cases it was we burned out, you know, it was a situation of burning out the young man's arm, and without any of the technology to fix it. You know, we still didn't have Tommy John surgery, yep, for example. So all we knew is somebody had a dead arm.
Well, I also think that, as my uncle used to tell me, there's only two or three guys in the lineup you got to bring your best stuff to. And people used to pace themselves. But now if you see a guy come in and they'll say, this guy can throw 99, his first eight pitches are 99. You never used to see that. I mean, I'm going to say Warren Spahn or Bob Gibson threw five max pitches the whole game. I mean, those guys could probably pitch 20 innings if you let a guy who could throw 99 wing him up there at 85. There's no comparison in softball. Hell, I used to watch. I'm not playing much anymore. But the guys who were pitching for the team that's still playing, my nephew Kevin, I talked to the pitcher, and they look at me like I got 15 heads, which maybe I do. Maybe nobody wants to listen to an old guy. I said, what are you doing over here? He goes, what are you talking about? I said, they're hitting batting practice. Watch the batting practice. See the two or three guys you got to be careful of. Why would I do that? You know, if I got to explain it to you, I'm wasting my time. I mean, you know the people in the lineup that can hurt you. And the trick is to keep the bases clean. Plus, the guy knows he's the guy that can hurt you. That's the difference between playing a really good team and a good neighborhood team. You can throw the ball behind a guy's head, and he's going to swing because he knows he's their hope. On a good team, if you go play like Lettuce or somebody, they take the walk and the next guy's just as good. That's why it's very difficult to. But otherwise, the other people, you don't just throw a batting practice pitch. But you throw it in there. They're no danger, really. I mean, they're going to land a hit once in a while, but most of the time, you're going to catch it. And then there's the two or three guys you got to worry about. Same thing in major leagues, right? I mean, the idea that you have to pitch, you know, throw 99 miles an hour to get out their 220 hitter. I don't see why you do. Do you? I mean, now if there's all kinds of guys behind you, then well, you might as well, I suppose. But the idea has changed. I mean, you don't think, you know, Juan Marichal or Warren Spahn that were throwing 140 pitches through? You think they threw 10 of them as hard as they could?
Well, yeah. The other part of it, Tom, is expectation and the way team rosters are developed now. So the expectation is that you're going to give us six innings, not nine. You know, there were, you know, how many guys had more complete games than they had victims. So you had that phenomenon. Now there's not that expectation anymore. And because, you know, you only had, what, you know, you probably had a pitching staff of 10.
Out of 25 players, they used to maybe have 10, 11, 12, and now there's like 14 of them are pitchers, right?
Yeah. Everybody spends a lot of their time on pitching, a lot of their roster on pitching, and they are perfectly fine with the idea of marching different guys out there for the, you know, one inning at a time.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it, you know, you can do max effort when you don't have to go nine innings. When we saw Spahn, Jenkins, you know, any of those guys pitch, it's, you know, their whole mission was to go the whole distance on there. So,
yeah,
you know, the mindset is different. That leads to the max effort pitching.
One of the greatest lines ever from Fergie Jenkins about all these complete games, and he was there, this is a long time ago, and he's in the booth, and they're asking him, what about Bruce Sutter? And he goes, if we'd had this guy, I'd have been happy to walk out in the eighth inning.
Yeah.
I'd have been happy to leave an inning earlier. This guy came in and mow him down, and we win. I would have been happy to see that. You know, we're down 77 points here. NSA Futures down 425. Kevin, what?
By the way, you mentioned Sutter. The first thing I always think of with Bruce Sutter is he had one of my favorite quirks. You know, since baseball players can be quirky, and his was that he, of course, like every reliever, he always pitched out of the stretch, which is fine. But when the bases were empty, he still looked at first base.
Oh,
he'd still go into the stretch, pause, check the runner on first, even when there wasn't one. It was just part of his routine. And so I always got a kick out of that. Anyway, keep going.
Well, Ken, this week I was mentioning yesterday that Larissa's been pretty much of a godsend, I think, for the show in the sense that she combines the intellectual stuff that you professor dudes and everybody else brings with the fact that she's a mom and a homemaker. She's basically got two jobs, both of them important jobs, in my opinion.
The show, I thought she just brought a pleasant personality to the show for a change.
Well, that part too. But this week was interesting. I couldn't believe, you know, Katie talking about the different things and stuff that Carl's always talking about. She's talking about, you know, places where the people are ordering tests they don't need and those kinds of things. And I just never thought I'd hear it flood out from somebody in the industry. But Katie's pretty straightforward. Typical Irish girl, I guess. But she's terrific. And just somehow, and Larissa's talking about the difference in the numbers this week. And we had, you know, the CPI and the PPI being pretty much horrible. And yet, if you look at it from the lady who's on TV that drives me bonkers is Stephanie Link, and she's probably very nice, but she's obviously talking her book, and she keeps stridently, plus she's louder than anybody else, which makes it like fingernails on a chalkboard, but talking about how strong the consumer is. And Larissa goes, well, if you take this grandiose view of the world and how much people spend, of course they're spending more, the prices are up. They're not buying as much of what they like. They're buying the needs. And probably they're at the edge of how much they make. And if a surprise comes up, it's going on a credit card. So if you want to be a, you know, toot your own horn moron, you can say the consumer's strong. She goes, that's not strong. You're spending because you have to. That's not the same as healthy. Healthy is not synonymous with strong. And you start piecing this all together and you look at the market and how incredibly narrow it has been lately and how some companies are just ridiculously, when I say ridiculously, I don't know how much Micron's worth, and if I was that smart, you know, whatever, we'd be vacationing in Ireland right now, Kevin, the whole group. But I do know that it probably isn't worth three times as much as it was 4 months ago. I mean, that seems a little bit of a stretch. Either there, the people 4 months ago were like really stupid. So you're seeing these gulps to where people don't even realize that, you know, a $20 move in a stock means. I mean, Cisco the other night, you know, a $20 move when you've had, you know, 3 billion shares outstanding. Well, hell, that's like a really lot of dough. I mean, to where I mean, if you even take a P/E ratio on how much the stock is up today, that's a big number. So you think you see people like losing track of some of this stuff, and yet some of the companies that I manage risk for people can't get out of their own way. I mean, they're down like every day. I mean, it's kind of scary. You know, I see in the new world, maybe they're not going to be able to do the stuff they did, so there's reasons for it. But somehow or another, there's a disconnect here that I don't quite, you know, and Trump made one of those most foolish comments the other day about where he said, I don't know, they caught him when he was getting on the helicopter and whatever, but he said something about, what do you think about, you know, how the oil price is affecting the American consumer? And his response, flat out there, I listened to it, I don't think about it, not even a little bit, or something along those lines. And I mean, what are you talking about? Now, on war policy tomorrow, I probably happen to agree with him. If you think you're going to do something good, if you think, which I think he probably thinks he is, you're going to do something good, and for 4 or 5 months, you know, people are going to suck up some oil prices. If at the end of the day, there's never another war in the Middle East, and everybody shuts down, and everybody can stop making money. If you can pull that off, I'm not going to say it's not worth 6 months at the pump. But if you don't, and all of a sudden it drags on and on and on, and then there's still no resolve, then people are looking at it, you know, I don't know. So, but I think you at least have to say, I'm very aware of how much it's hurting people, and clearly we're doing this. We know there's a price to be paid, and these are our goals, and if we make them, everybody's going to be happy and say it was money well spent. That's the answer, I think. I mean, I hope
that would be an empathetic answer. It would be politically a good answer. And yeah, I was thinking of that anyway. Let's just say he gets a good outcome out of this, and we do start to see, you know, I don't know how fast they'll drop, but we certainly start to see oil prices dropping, and gasoline prices dropping, and my God, diesel prices have to drop; they're so high. If we see all that, his message needs to be like a big thank you to the American people.
Yeah.
You know, saying thank you, you know, for putting up with this. I know it was hard for you, and I believe it was worth it. But it was paying for this that is just as I won't say just as responsible as any military, but was responsible for the success, was a big part of the responsibility. Make the success be part of the American public's success. And, you know, that would be, I think, a much stronger political message than see, we got him down, you know, see, good for us. No, it's got to be, you know, sort of like letting the American people have a share of the success, assuming there is a successful outcome. And I think that would be, going into the midterms, a much, much stronger message.
Well, you have to wonder, I mean, who's running the show? And I'm not, everybody knows my feelings about the current guy, but you can go back how many guys, Kevin, and, you know, who's really running the show? For a long time, I mean, anybody who was in academia thought that the real runners of the government were the oil companies. Now it appears to be the new masters of the universe. It's the chip guys and those guys. But there always seems to be this undercurrent of people that somehow or another wield influence way more than the votes in their pocket, shall we say. And, you know, you do wonder, I mean, you, some people, I'll talk about the guy who bought it was the refineries owned by Citgo that originally were the Venezuelan investors that were in some of these places. Because Venezuela had a big chunk of Citgo for a while. I don't know if they still do. But there was two pieces. There's the gas stations and there was refineries. And refineries were these, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 of them down in the Gulf someplace that were tailored to do Venezuelan oil. And as Venezuelan oil kept going down, 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 because the Venezuelan government was so screwed up, these guys are gagging. And so these things are essentially in bankruptcy. The stopgap was to do the pipeline to essentially replace that crummy oil with the crummy oil from the tar sands in Canada. Well, that got bleep canned, so that didn't happen. So all of a sudden, this guy, the big contributor to campaign, and I'm just saying the facts, whether he was able to walk into the White House and make policy, I don't know. And I hope not. all of a sudden, like a couple of weeks before we snatched the guy from Venezuela, this guy makes a deal and brings these things out of bankruptcy. Well, the first shiploads of oil like go right to his places. I'm going, this can't be. What is NCIS? What does Gibbs say? There's no such thing as a circumstance. I mean,
coincidence.
Yeah, coincidence. Yeah, it's a coincidence. And okay. Now that guy today has to be, if he's exporting diesel, Jesus, Kevin, and he's getting a good price out of Venezuela, how much is that dude making? I mean, wouldn't you like to be that guy for a day? Jesus. Some people, there's always huge winners in this and losers. And I'm just sort of tired of the listeners and me being on the losing end. I mean, as I age, I'm just kind of grumpy about that. But what can I tell you?
Well, we should get somebody into the conversation who's always a winner.
Yeah.
And because I'm well into Carl's time, so.
Surprised he hasn't piped out. He likes these issues.
Oh, I'm here.
You're here? What's up? How are you?
Carl's always very polite. I forget.
Well,
I forget to say, hey, Carl, you should chime in on this. So,
I do it to other people, though, once in a while, so it's okay.
Are you sure you're not just watching the screen here down Short 10 Futures, seeing the NASDAQ down 470?
Oh, I would never do something like Short the Futures. I'd never do. Now, I will admit, if I got a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning that, I ought to short a bunch of QM.
Yeah.
Yeah, that didn't happen fairly recently. It did.
No.
By the way, I don't know if you saw this, but there is, from my best research, there is no, so there was a lot of grilling that went on with this, with Warsh and his private equity held stuff. Okay, Elizabeth Warren was all over him about, you say you're going to get rid of it, but you haven't told us where it is.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't answer the question, okay, as to what he held. He just kept saying, I'm going to dump it before the effective date of my approval. Elizabeth Warren and I have, I don't know that we actually have enough in common that I'd go drink a beer with her, but the reality of it is that was an entirely legitimate line of questioning, all right? Not just because the reality of it is that whether you hold it or not, it tells people a great deal about where you stand, where you think value lies, and where you think things, capital and credit ought to be allocated in an economy. All right, now if you're, in this position, now if you want to be a doctor, I guess that really doesn't make much difference, unless of course it's all in pharmaceutical companies. But if you want to be the chair of the Fed, I think it does matter. I think it's an entirely germane question, to the job.
You guys, we still have Kevin. I want to get both of you guys' opinion. I know I sent that.
But here's the reason I brought that up there, Chief.
You tap into all kinds of other stuff than
what me redirect back to where I was going with this. All right, because it just shows up in the last day or so that apparently Trump, although the president does not have constraints on holding things while he's in office, like virtually every other federal office holder does, he still has to report it, still has to go to the Office of Government Ethics, the OGE guys. Apparently, he's been buying NVIDIA.
That doesn't surprise me.
Single company stocks. Wait a minute. What in the hell, by the way, the CEO was just flying over to China on Air Force One.
They picked him up in Alaska.
Yeah, they did. So, excuse me. Now, of course, the only corrective action you can apply to the president in this situation is impeachment. There is no statute that says you can't deliberately deal through the back door of the White House. There's nothing that's... Now, if you or I did something like that, Chief, that's a crime, trading on inside information like that.
Yes, but I Here's where I sent that little missive out to you guys and the rest of the people on the show. And as we try and talk to people and explain what things are, there, I'm noticing there's a big difference in what we think necessarily is right and wrong and what maybe people younger. And it's not a question of them being immoral or whatever. It's, and I mentioned you as a one of the protagonists in this. You can talk about antitrust, but you can only talk it about so much to somebody who hasn't even heard the term in 30 years.
Yeah.
I mean, there's when I go back to my buddy Jim Doherty, real smart guy. When I first got the SIBO and I started doing some stuff, and I said, Jim, how is it that these people in Washington, what is it, what they do, can they hold stuff? He goes, oh, no, because it's actually a horseshit job, being a representative. You're making 40 grand a year or something. You got to have two houses. And, oh, by the way, you put all your stuff, if you have any investments, you got to put it in a private, you know, what do you call it?
A blind trust.
Blind trust.
Right.
And I thought, dummy that I am, that that was some kind of a, quote, law. Well, it turns out it was more like a gentleman's agreement.
And a suggestion.
And people did it. And now all of a sudden, you know, there might have been somebody before him, but the person who stands out in my mind is saying, up yours, I'm not doing that, was Dick Cheney. When he said, right. No, wait a minute. And he said, I got my stuff. It's my money. And by the way, I'm managing it while I'm vice president. And nothing really happened to him. And so I don't even, was it a law? Was it a, you know, a half-assed executive order? Was it a convention? And all of a sudden, Elizabeth Warren talking to this guy, if he's been around Washington the last 25 years, he doesn't even know what she's talking about. What do you mean? Everybody manages their own crap. The people in Congress are trading. The people in the White House are trading. You're talking about, you're like Carl talking about the Sherman Act. What the hell's the Sherman Act? I mean, it's almost like we think it's wrong, but it's also so odd to these guys that they don't even know why it's wrong. I mean, I don't know where we are on this. That's why I want your guys' opinion.
Like I said, this is just to me, you know, because the list of some of these companies has now hit, you know, has hit the wires. Okay.
Well, Carl, the other day, everybody on the plane, their stock was up like 5 or 10%.
Well, duh.
Yeah.
Okay, but here's the thing. However, the president of the United States both bought the stock and issued the invitation.
Yeah.
Now, if that's not insider trading, please tell me what
but
is.
I guess right? The message I'm trying to get here, and I'm sorry I'm beating you guys up on this, but this guy, when Elizabeth Warren is basically bitching at him, it's not like he's looking very uncomfortable and saying,
no, he's not.
And saying, you got me. He's like, so what? And that, to me, that's a huge difference. Am I beating this up too much, or are you guys with me on this?
Well, no, I think you are to an extent, because the thing is, here's Chief, if this is exactly like an umpire taking $500 from the Padres coach,
yeah,
5 minutes before he strolls out on the field, right?
Yeah,
I mean that is exactly what this is. Okay, oh well, he's supposed to call that. You know, that's the third base umpire. He's supposed to call the tags at the bag, right? I mean, that's his job. Hello.
But the response to Warsh was not Elizabeth Warren, you know, bringing this up. It's not like every other senator said, well, if this guy's not going to get rid of his stuff, we're not voting for him. They didn't pay any attention to it at all.
No, I understand that. I'm simply saying that I don't have, you know, the people who were outraged that she went after him on this, like I said, there's absolutely no congruence between what Elizabeth Warren believes is appropriate policy for the United States and what I believe. I doubt that I could find an area of agreement.
I'll bet out of 10 items, you agree on 4.
You
might not agree on the solution, but you'll agree that she's identified a problem that maybe other people are walking blindly by.
Well, okay, all right, perhaps.
Which to me is sort of the same thing. That's a start.
Yeah, perhaps, I suppose. I just, you know, it was one of those things that when I saw this, I was like, You got to be kidding me. This really is how far we've fallen as a nation. And yet everybody and their damn brother is running around saying, "Oh, you know, that's not a thing." Or, you know, whatever. What do you mean it's not a thing?
Even somebody like AOC, which every solution she's ever come up with, I pretty much disagree with. Yet the fact that she brings up stuff about people who are waitresses at that level of society, what they're feeling, other people don't even care about that. I mean, at least she brings something up that ought to be brought up. Now, I don't like her solutions. I mean, I don't like Bernie Sanders' solutions. Yeah, I keep wanting to send the guy a calculator. But the fact is, he's right about some of the things he sees.
Yeah, well, that was just one of those moments that, and then in the context of it, then this stuff with Trump and, you know, and the fact that he's actively trading while sitting in the left seat of the plane.
He is, the man has zero morals.
Well,
he's totally immoral.
Well, gee, that's a little bit of a problem, don't you think?
Well, I mean, I understand somebody who's immoral. I know a lot of guys, but it's like people say, Lyndon Johnson used to take a bag of currency. Okay, that tells me that he at least knew what morals was, and he was willing to hide it. He knew he had to hide it. He didn't just say, "What's the problem?" and just give me the check in front of everybody, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just the thing that I find fascinating, though, especially in the context of things like NVIDIA, is that and NVIDIA is the Cisco of from the 2000, right? From the March of 2000 timeframe. Except it's worse. NVIDIA has a market cap of somewhere north of $5 trillion at this point.
Right? It's like, well, it's pretty simple. It's 230 times 25 billion, so whatever that is.
Yeah, but it's something like $5.3 trillion or something like this. That is, for perspective for people, there are exactly two nations that have a GDP, all goods and services, that are greater than that. Guess which they are.
It's got to be us and China.
It is.
Now, do you think this guy...
Now, wait a minute. It gets worse, okay? If you go to the eighth position in global GDP, which is France, anything below that, the company has a greater alleged market value than any two nations after number eight in the list, combined. Now, anybody that believes that that is a realizable actual valuation, in other words, that there's actually productive something now or down the road in that, is crazy as the people in 1998 and 1999 that believed that all of the S1 claims... And this is why I got out of the business, was all of a sudden going to expand the global GDP of the world by a factor of 10. No, it wasn't. And no, this isn't.
You know what the,
and yet,
you know what the revenue
day,
per share is?
Huh?
You know what the revenue per share is?
Hmm.
Like $9.
Yeah, I believe that.
So that's nine goes into 230. What does that give you, 25 or something?
Yeah, like stupid, right?
So how can a company
well, price
that big
to sales? Double? I mean, price to sales is sales, right? Actual
yeah.
sales,
yeah.
All right? Now nobody
they got like a 50% margin.
Well,
which
goes to the next problem,
which means their earnings per share is like 50.
Well, but the next problem is that anybody that has a 50% margin, if you don't have some way to prevent people from shooting at you, they will. Duh, right? By the way, their patents just expired.
Well, don't you think that in the last 6 months with the incredible rise in Micron, AMD, and Intel that somebody's sniffing a competitor, but now they're as crazy expensive as these guys? So.
Well, no. Here's... All right, so, one of my Chief, one of my hot button issues that I hammer on all time is collusive behavior within business and essentially what amounts to a
nobody monopoly. Do you think this guy who runs NVIDIA think that's wrong?
Obviously not. He's Chinese.
And he's got to be playing Z and Trump like a couple of ping pong balls.
Well, he's Chinese.
Yeah.
Okay. However, here's the basic problem. It's the same thing I brought up on the show. You know, was it Tuesday? McDonald's has a 45% operating margin. They sell a commodity. They sell hamburgers. All right. Now, the issue that you run into with things like this is that people say, you know, a few years ago when I went to this conference and was asked to be part of a panel related to AI and some of the challenges, you know, where it was going to go, and I brought up the fact that all of these large language models were industrial level copyright violators of registered works, which carries a statutory penalty per infringement, and that everyone in the business was acting like this law didn't exist, that there was absolutely nothing wrong with doing any of this, and that while they may
go back to my letter the other day, well, younger people don't even know what you're talking about.
Well, but by the way, those statutory damages are $250,000 per work infringed.
And how many people are getting prosecuted? I'm not. You know, well, by the way, you well, know, I'm with you on this. I'm just saying.
I get that. And the point I made on the panel was that I'm not saying that people are going to end up being instantly bankrupted and thrown in prison for doing this. I said, however, the penalties for violating this law are large enough to destroy Google, Microsoft, Intel. You know, I don't care what firm it is. I don't care what their market cap is, and I don't care how much cash they have. If you get tagged on this, you're done. It makes absolutely no difference how big you are or how big a wiener you wave around. Now, that doesn't mean that in the world we live today that you're not going to be able to go to the President of the United States or the Attorney General or the DOJ or whoever and say, if you prosecute us, the entire effing economy is going to explode, therefore you can't. All right? Essentially taking the law hostage because you've gotten large enough that you can do that and get away with it.
They're doing that, and they also see the Department of Justice, maybe under the last few people, it'll be nice, is absolutely on the take as well, it appears.
Well, yeah.
I got a question for you.
By the way, here's $1 million in an envelope. Shut up and go away. Right.
What? Just in terms of history on these laws. I mean, I guess I sort of knew this stuff at one point. I used to write a column. You write a column all the time now. I used to write one. And if I do some math and I write a column about, you know, price earnings and stuff of NVIDIA, this is all public stuff. If I put all this stuff in there, and let's say AI runs by and, like, grabs my stuff. I mean, I guess I don't have a whole lot of defense. And what is the difference if I wrote for the Tribune, say?
Well, okay.
Okay, let me get the question up. Yeah. Once in a while, you would see an article that said copyright, and somebody actually. What is the difference now? Can I not take the content of the copyright?
No. Here's the difference. When I create something, when I write an article, or I take a photograph, okay. When I create something, by that act of creation, I have a copyright. All right. However, my damages, if you steal it and use it, my damages in that circumstance are limited to the economic harm that you did to me, and I have to prove it. Now, needless to say, that's kind of hard, right? How much economic harm did you do to me if I'm a columnist for the Tribune and I, you know, you steal the article and use it, right? Well, okay, how many copies of the paper didn't get sold? How does that impact my earnings? I mean, you know, go ahead and try to prove those damages, right? That's not easy. And you have to prove the damages. However, if I register the work, which is very cheap, I can, for $25, take a physical piece of media, a CD, whatever. I can print it off on paper, too, but these days, everybody, you register work, you do it electronically. I can register a compilation of these things. So I can take, for example, my all the photographs that I took in the last month and file them with the Copyright Office. And that's very inexpensive to do. The filing costs money, but the number of things actually in the filing is not really all that relevant. So let's say I write a piece of computer software. Now, normally, to claim a copyright, you must file a full and complete copy with the Copyright Office. Obviously, if you do that with computer software, you just disclosed it to everybody that can use it.
That's why a lot of people don't want to get patents. They tell everybody what it is.
Well, because they have to be disclosed, okay? But for software, there is an exception. The first and last 25 pages of the source code is acceptable. So you don't actually, depending on how you structure things and such, You don't have to disclose all the cheese. Essentially, you just have to disclose enough that if somebody steals it, you can prove they did it, okay? But with a photograph or a published paper or
book or whatever, the guy who did, like, we talked about it years ago, like the guy who wrote the 3 or 4 day expose in the, I think it was the Washington Post, regarding the horseshoe of disparity you and I have referred to.
Right.
Now, that was going to be, that was at least a half a page 5 days in a row. So it was almost like a small novel. He went out and copyrighted that, correct? I mean, there, this is a copyright thing by Carl Denninger.
Right. So you can put the copyright notice on anything that you create because you have one at the point of creation, okay, under the law. But like I said, without registration, you can only recover actual damages.
I think when they do that in the paper, they actually registered.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
So does a magazine. So does Microsoft when they publish Windows. Or when somebody, or even if you don't. I mean, like, for example, the code that I have that runs my house, which I at one time contemplated commercializing, that's a registered work. I sent that in and registered it. Why? Because if somebody steals it, by God, I'm going to go after him for statutory damages. All right.
Well, is that why we got to break here?
You have to register before you can sue under the statute for statutory damages.
Oh, we got to go to break and talk about these horrible numbers in the market this morning. But
yeah,
is that why when I don't know how I got sent one, but now I'm somewhat of addicted to it. This Quora, especially if you love baseball or World War II stuff, there'll be somebody. Compare the P-51 to the P-47, right? Some guy will actually write hundreds of words with pictures comparing the two to a point where now I know the difference between the two. Or same way with baseball. What about the best second base? But now when I go in there, it's got to give me that you got to prove you're not a human. Is that so AI can't just go in and steal everything everybody writes in there?
Yes and no. They don't care so much about the stealing from their point of view. What they care about is the load. It's the same problem that pretty much everybody on the internet now has, is that these hyperscaler training systems that are running are doing so in a way that does severe, it imposes cost on the operator of the site, and not small either. And it's in, so Google does this to index, okay, as do other search engines, but they're pretty respectful about it. And there is, it's not a law, but there's an informal code of conduct, and they follow it. And the reason they follow it is that if they violate it, you can block them. And depending on how aggressive you want to get, you can essentially make it impossible for them to index things. So if they're pricks, there is a pushback mechanism that the market has that makes that an uneconomic decision. The hyperscaler guys don't care. And as a result, my software, for example, for the forum, even though not an awful lot of the stuff is gated, you have to have an active contribution subscription in order to be able to get to it. But not everything. The articles on the top level are visible. They're there. But the software is extraordinarily punitive if it catches somebody doing this, and it will blackball not just the source string that they're coming from. It'll blackball the actual IP block they're coming from.
All right, we're going to dash off the break. Hold that thought, bud.
Yeah.
SP Futures down 91. Yeah, 91. NASDAQ Futures down 512. Carl, while we're on break, think about how many planes were the Chinese supposed to buy in Boeing? Boy, the stock ran up, and now it's running right back down. And allegedly, the number was 200. I don't know if it was signed or not. Anyway, we'll be right back. Stocks and Jocks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Lower North Bank Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Ricky on the board. SP Futures down 91. Yeah, 91. NASDAQ Futures down 512. Dow Futures down 404. So we're getting whacked here all over the place. The only thing that's not getting whacked is oil, which is not so good. DAX down 480. That's 2%. That's a lot. FTSE down 202. That's 2%. That's a lot. CAC around down 131. Only 1.7%. So I guess they're hanging in there, for lack of a better term. Nikkei down 1,200 bucks. That's 2%. Hang Seng down 426. 1.6%. Shanghai only down 42. 1%. So they're somewhat hanging in there. Yesterday we were up 56 in the S&P 500. We're up 232 in the NASDAQ. So we've kind of blown through that by almost double. Ouch. Bonds up 9 basis points, 4.55 on the 10-year. Again, that's not good. I've got the 30-year is at 5.1. We've been talking about this now for weeks. It just keeps creeping. 10-year is blown through 4.5 like dinner through a goose at 4.55. Not good on mortgage rates, not good on anything. Oil up 329, 104.46. RBOB is up to 365, so add like a dollar on that, or plus or minus 20 cents based on the transportation and taxes in your state, and you're talking about $4.90 a gallon, which is about right where it is here. So do the math and it kind of works out sometime. Gold, however, not so good. Gold's on 127 bucks, 45.57. Good thing we got puts in there. Silver down 670 after a big rally. We were worried about this thing blowing through 90 yesterday. Now it just blew through 80 the other way, 78.74. Foreign exchange, dollar is moving up here. The euro's down to 116.3. It was over 117 3 days ago. British pound, 133.5, was over 135. So we're talking pushing 1% moves in these currencies, which is a real lot. Crypto, down only 933 bucks, 80,523. So crazy stuff we'll be talking about in a minute. Ricky, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Are you going to the Cubs Sox game tonight?
Hey, good morning, Chief. I wish I could, man, but I have other plans.
Oh, God.
But today...
Don't tell me you got a date.
No, I do not, actually. I have something even more boring than that. but today is looking pretty good in Chicago, man. It's 56 degrees right now with a high of 73. A morning shower, it spots, otherwise breezy with partial sunshine and a high of 73, of course. Tonight will be partly cloudy with a thunderstorm late and a low of 61 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 76 degrees right now with a high of 100. Hot with plenty of sunshine, so make sure you stay hydrated if outside for too long. Tonight will be clear with a low of 74 degrees. No accidents reported so far. Actually, there is one, and I'll tell you about it in just a minute. Well, we are seeing some congestion in the expressways. The bridge work at Foster Avenue is definitely causing some stop-and-go traffic. Inbound starting at Cumberland Avenue and ending at Lawrence Avenue, the traffic. Light traffic on Eisenhower in both directions. Traffic on Stevenson inbound starts just before Central Avenue and ends at South Pulaski Road. And finally, if you're coming in from Dan Ryan, expect some delays as there was an accident that's blocking the left lane at... Give me 2 seconds here. Blocking the left lane at exit 62. That's going to be 92nd Street. Let's go sports real quick. Yesterday was a great day for Chicago baseball. Cubs beat Braves 2-0 and Sox beat Royals 6-2. Today we got the cross Jamestown Classic, as you were saying, Chief. Cubs at White Sox at 6:40 p.m. Additionally, Diamondbacks face Rockies in Denver at 7:40 p.m. For the NHL, yesterday the Golden Knights won the series against the Ducks after a victory of 5-1 and move on to play Avalanche on May 20th. Additionally, Canadiens and Sabres beat Sabres 6-3 and lead the series 3-2. Finally, for the NBA semifinals, Game 6, Pistons at Cavaliers today at 6 p.m. and Spurs at Timberwolves today at 8:30 p.m. Back over to you, Chief.
Carl, this is I don't think I've ever seen as narrow of a market for a reason.
Well,
The other day, the people on the plane, all their stocks were up, and just about I won't say everybody else was down, but a lot of other stocks were down.
Yeah, the general direction X them was down.
Yeah.
This is one of the other things, and there's also, I watch a bunch of internal stuff on a daily basis. I watch up down volume, I watch the ticks and the trends, and the reason I do it is because those indicators, of course, are across the entire market, right? Up down volume, down volume. Not, you know, five names that are moving whatever because of their market cap. You know, indexes are market cap weighted indexes for the most part. So, you know, the Dow is price weighted, but still, the nasty part of this is that this last acceleration has had two characteristics that ought to scare the living hell out of anybody that's ever actually been in the market for any length of time.
Well, anybody who was here in 2000, it should bother.
Well, if you're in 2000, or if you were here in to some extent in 2007, 2008, I don't know whether or not this was true, you know, in 1929, because the data's not there. I can't go back and look. But in 2000, I saw it, and it was the same pattern. It's what I call a distribution pattern. And essentially, what it tells you is that while you have the market advancing on an overall basis and quite strongly, the internals do not confirm this. And that's because the advance that is coming from that handful of names. So if you go look at SOX, and it's gone vertical the last couple of months, that is, you know, when you see this kind of a pattern in the internals, the thing to do is to go to try to figure out, okay, where is the off the standard move coming from in both directions? Okay, you've got the market taking a header, you know, same kind of thing applies, right? You want to go try to look at where that's coming from. If those other internal indicators say that shouldn't be the case, when your up down volume, your trend and your tick are confirming they're going in the same direction as the market is moving, then okay, that's broad based. That's the market is advanced. The economy is improving deteriorating.
If all this stuff seems better, everybody's going up the same. The tide is lifting everybody. That's actually very healthy. And why I'm in the business?
Yeah, it's a good thing from a standpoint of, you know, it could be wrong. Okay, because you know the incredible delusion of crowds, right? However, if it's wrong across the entire panoply of stocks. And then one of the other things that you've brought up multiple times, and I watch as well, is that where's the coverage on margin, and which direction is that going? Okay, now in advancing markets, margin tends to expand. Duh.
It always
however,
does. It's the easiest loan to get.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
However, the question, and that is less relevant than the coverage ratio of margin. In other words, of the available margin that is out from margin, now, you know, my accounts are marginable. I don't use it, but they are marginable. All right? So, I mean, if I want to, I can.
Sure you can.
But, you know, do I have a reason to take out a loan from a brokerage, which is essentially what you're doing, right?
Without a doubt, without a doubt.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you pay interest on the margin debt. Right now, I have no reason to do that. But that doesn't mean I can't, and there have been times that I have. So, just as one example, when I moved from Chicago down to Florida, I wrote a check off my brokerage account to buy the house. And paid the margin debt for a month because it was I was selling the one in Chicago, but until that house closed, why did I want to go originate a mortgage?
We have people that have done that here. We do not have, well, I won't say never.
Well, we
don't have somebody who says, I want to buy 1,000 shares of IBM. What's the minimum I can send you? We don't have anybody like that.
Yeah, but the thing is,
but there are that's big business for everybody like that.
Oh, of course it is, and they make a hell of a lot of money doing it, too.
And the interest, sure.
Yeah, but, well, and most of the brokerages, the margin rates are ridiculous. However, it was considerably cheaper to do that and pay that for a month on those cross transactions than it was to pay the origination fees and all the other garbage to take out a mortgage. Okay, the amount of interest that I paid over that month was, yeah, okay, it was real, but it was a lot less than I would have paid to do all the other crap, right? Plus, it was easier. It took, you know, it took 30 seconds. Set up the wire, go here. But the coverage ratio now, in other words, how much of that available out is actual out? I saw a statistic the other day that it's in excess of 80%.
Wow.
Now, that'll scare the hell out of everybody. Because if there is a cascading type of sell-off that gets going, like we had happen in the early months of 2000, those are very rapidly going to end up exceeding your carrying limit. And then the clerk calls, and you either wire more money or you liquidate something or they'll do it for you.
Well, I mean, it...
And you probably won't like the decision they make if they do it.
Well, but I don't want to... You know, zero in on the, we're doing the same thing as you know, as tulips, but but maybe we are. If everybody just called up PTI Securities and you bought 1,000 shares of IBM and you sent us $220,000, if went up it'd be good, went down wouldn't be so good, but there's no impetus. You can say if it's now worth $200,000, I still like IBM. It's not an issue. But if you borrowed 110 of the 220, and now even though we have this margin that you don't on the future side, you can't do this, by the way, which
That's
makes
right.
it more difficult. But on the security side, after the 29 crash, you used to have to come up with 1-to-1. When I say 1-to-1, if you came up with 1,000 shares of IBM and you bought it for 220, in those days, and in a soybean or any futures contract, if IBM's down $1 today, all right, so you got 1,000 shares, and you put up 50% or 20% or whatever the number was back then. My guy's calling you going, hey, Carl, we need $2,200.
Now.
Because now you're only covering, you know, 20% or 19% right. of the 20 you're supposed to have. And but now you slip from 50 to 30%. You don't get the call or the notification these days, until you get down to 30. You might...
Well, initial and maintenance margin
are different.
Right.
Initial is 50 and maintenance is 30. So you get a spread there. So you don't get this panic on the first day. But right. also, if you got a firm like us, and we start seeing it nudging to 35, 34, hopefully we're going to call you. Now, I'm not so sure these electronic guys are. We're going to call you and say... what do you want to do here? What are you thinking? You really like the stock? Should you lighten up a little bit? Now, by the way, we have two platforms here. People that, I don't know how much they know about PTI, but it's a pretty good firm. I wouldn't be here since I own it, my brother and I.
Oh, really?
And other people. Yeah. So, but I mean, on the IB side, Interactive Brokers, we whiteboard their stuff. And they're like the world's best electronic people. They don't give a crap, Carl. If you duck below, if you're 29.9 at 2:03, they're pumping out 100 shares.
Oh yeah.
There's no phone call. There's no nothing. But now the part, you know, most of our people are still at RBC, except the people who like really doing electronic. If you're doing electronic stuff, IB is probably the best platform there is. If you're a professional trader, I mean, you're good. You want to do spreads, those kinds of things. It feels like nobody else can. But on the other side, we're going to call you and say, hey. What's your plan here? You sure you got the right?
There's some
ham handholding, but you know.
Well, Chief, the reason that IB doesn't is because the reason they're able to offer what they offer is because they don't spend money making
right.
phone calls like
right.
that. Their computer is programmed that the moment you violate, they solve it.
Yeah,
and that's it. And you know, and if you're a professional trader, you understand that's how it works.
Yeah,
well, I mean those are the rules. Yeah. By the way, this move that we've got in the bond spreads, you know, I think I've been talking for a while. I brought this up a bunch of times on the show with you, that for the average Joe that doesn't have access to a Bloomberg terminal or something like that, where they can watch, you know, because Santelli always talks about the toots tens, right? That one's a little bit more difficult to get if you're not a professional trader in terms of actually being able to chart it and track it. All right, the ten's easy because you got the TNX, but the two is not. However, the IRX, which is the 13-week bill, is on all the platforms. Okay, so you can do a differential between those two. We went out last night with a spread of 872 between the two, 8.72 positive, which, by the way, has been trending in the general upward direction for quite some time now. We just unlocked when we were talking. We're now at 969. Now that is not a small move.
Right.
All right.
Well, the last week or two has been a big move in this stuff.
Well, I understand. Yeah. And here's the thing. The 30-year, you know, that auction was horrible.
Yep.
Okay. And blew out at, you know, over 5%. So I have said for a long while that the consequence of this, of these exponential moves within government spending and running 7% fiscal deficits, the reality is that the neutral rate of interest, even on the 13-week bill, is something slightly over, maybe, you know, 20, 50 basis points, over 7% if you're running a 7% fiscal deficit. That's where the zero rate is, because that's the monetary inflation that's being forced into the system. Now, only an idiot intentionally lights $100 bills on fire,
right,
on purpose. People do it all the time by accident because they make an investment and it turns out to be bad. Okay, that's, you know, we've all had those bad trades, right? You've had them, I've had them, we've all had them. That's fine. But to intentionally light money on fire is not something that people generally do.
No.
And the reason that large banks, who are not stupid, are willing to put that out there is because they're screwing people on the other side, which is why your credit card interest rate is 25%. And yet they're getting, if they're buying a 13-week bill, they're getting the IRX rate, which is, you know, 3.6 right now, roughly. Okay. So they're getting 3.6, but the purchasing power is being damaged to the extent of 7, which is double that.
Yes, it's at least double that.
Well, it's double that. Now, how is it that these guys are able to do that and stay in business? And the answer is they're screwing you
at
22% on the credit card.
Okay, we've been noticing it for a while, and I was on Joel's show the other day, and he says, "Chief, what's your big worry in a stock market?" I goes, "That's easy, Joel. 8% rates or something like that." And he said, "That'll never happen."
Yes,
and
it will.
And I told a dumb story about, Robin and I got a bridge loan at 8.5% in November, and by June it was like 14. I got a scar to prove it. But so, I mean, this move today, but I'm looking here, I got two things up here. In terms of this foreign debt, and I told you I was mentioning she's the spokesman for this economic group that does these YouTube things, and I've watched a couple of them now, and their reports are, somehow or another, she knew how many. I mean, I'm looking here, and I got numbers from 226. This is on foreign holders or debt. She knew how much Japan sold last week. Where's she getting that data?
I believe that's probably coming off the New York Fed desk. That would be my guess. I mean, that's what it is, a guess. But my suspicion is that the data's there, but you have to figure out, you know, you have to dig through it.
Well, anyway,
all that stuff clears through there.
I mean, I know it's. I just. That's why I said, who do I know? It's better at data again than anybody, my buddy Carl. But here I'm looking at two things here. a little bit of what she's talking about and whatever, and it kind of ties in with this interest rate stuff. China has had, like I mentioned earlier, they've got economic problems, right, even though they think they don't. The last
they do,
February 2025, they own $784 billion of U.S. debt. They're now down to $693. And if you went back a few years, I think at one point they were over $1 trillion, but I'm not positive on that. That has been picked up by Japan is up. They're now $1.24 trillion. Last year they were $1.12 trillion. And Britain is now, UK, is now $897 billion, and they were $750 billion. So these countries who are supposed to be our biggest allies. I mean, I don't know who the hell our allies are with this guy in office, but they're supposed to be our biggest ally.
Well, I know who they're not.
Yeah, and I know people on the show, maybe even you, Carl, said, you know, screw the people from UK. Well, for God's sake, we owe them $900 billion. I mean, normally you don't say, you know. So the people that were hurting with this oil stuff, anyway, to tie into this article and then get back to Carl because I'm talking too much, is she said in the last week, they spent $55 billion, quote, protecting their currency, which means when the currency runs down, they take their dollars and they buy their own currency.
Right.
And so, because they still have dollar reserves. Well, they paid $55 billion because whenever the yen gets to 160 to a dollar, they kind of,
They freak out about it.
So they drove it back down to 158. So, okay. So now, and she said they $9 billion of that came from direct treasury sales.
Right.
Now when she goes down, this is, she didn't say it this way, I mean, it's basically the pimple on the ass of an elephant, but it's a pimple that can get bigger. If they have to start doing this every week to pay for this oil, because, as I mentioned before, and again, it's something we got to keep track of, I think, Japan gets stung both ways. You only grab oil, buy oil, grab oil, in dollars. So they have to take the yen into dollars for the oil. So if the oil's up 25%, and by the way, the yen drops 4%, that's 30, right? It's not 25. Right. So they're getting it both ways here. So her point is the Japan and the UK have essentially covered, more than covered, China's bagging out on us. Now, everybody else is up here, too. Canada. We don't like Canada anymore. We owe them $450 billion. If I borrowed money from everybody and I went around and say what assholes the guys I just bought the money for, would that be something I would normally do?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
Carl, lend me $100. Guys, just Carl an asshole. It just wouldn't be something I would generally do the next day, but just saying.
You would think that would not be the case, right? Yeah. You'd think a lot of things, though, Chief,
yeah,
but it's not, you know, not the case these days. I think the most interesting piece of this is that as I've been pointing out for a while, the crack that comes from this ultimately is that when you put this kind of imbalance into the system at this sort of a level for this length of time. And look, this has become policy essentially at the government level.
Yeah.
All right. We have put these essentially a 7% forced inflation rate into the economy. I don't care if it's a Democrat or a Republican in office. It has made no difference. This number has accelerated. It's all coming out of CMS. I talk about this all the time. That's where the increase is coming from. You're seeing CMS spend is going up 10-11% a year.
Yeah, but now we're running the other stuff up with it, which is even worse.
Well, I understand that. But the thing is that people have, for the last, you know, really since the 07-08 blow-up, all right, which is when this became institutionalized, the curve was always positive as opposed to the percentage of deficit spending as a percentage of GDP. All right? And I've put this graph up. It's easy. You can go on Fred and you can look at it. There have been a couple of times, right around 2000 is the turn, when, you know, when greed scam dumped interest rates because, by God, the world was going to come to an end, and he threw money into the system and da-da-da-da-da, all this. Okay, fine. However, on a sustained basis, this had never been done before. And after 2008, it became the norm.
Yep.
And we haven't had a positive sloped curve.
Right, so what caused that? in your
well,
mind?
Because we, what caused it was Congress.
Well, no, I'm saying the difference in mentality, and we got a few minutes, was in 2000, the Fed dumped a bunch of money in for the Y2K thing.
But then they took it back out
Then they took it back out. Right. And what happened to the market? The high flyers, when the money went right into the market, high flyers came down. 2007, yeah. 2008, and in 2020, somebody during COVID said, no, we are not going to let that happen because the people who just made all this money are really the people that are in control. So somehow or another, we're going to protect that and hope somehow we don't screw everybody else to a huge extent, but they did with through inflation. Right. But, you know, let's talk about this on Tuesday, Carl. If this goes where you and I think it might, and by the way, we sure as hell don't, and I think the end game here is going to be, even if the market goes down some, you're going to have 5 or 6% of the population, maybe 10, that basically have all the dough.
And no way.
Okay. Well, a lot of it. They have a lot of the money.
Okay. Well, they have a lot of the money now.
Okay. I'm saying. And everybody else, you can't get blood out of a turnip. And, oh, by the way, the government's broke and the company's country's overseas. You know what I think they're going to end up having to do? Instead of taxing people, they may have to do that. They're going to demand that the Elon Musks of the world that have $90 bazillion and there's never been a dividend in the company.
Right.
They're going to demand that they buy 1% government paper so they can turn around and redeem the other stuff that they can't afford the interest on.
Well,
that's not. Now think about that for a second. I know your instinct is going to say to disagree that'll never happen, but what else could they do?
Well, they can try to demand it, but they're going to have a problem actually attempting to implement it.
The implementation will be. But I'm saying at some point you're going to say it's either this or the market goes down, one or the other.
Well, the market's going to go down.
You're going to go down anyway, yeah. But to what extent? I ask you that for a reason. I hopefully always ask you something. If the queues go from 708, where they are now, to 550, nobody's going to like it. My clients aren't going to like it. Nobody's going to like it. But in 2000, it went from 120 to what? 20.
Chief.
That's a big difference. That'd be like if we went from 750 to like 100 or something.
We could very easily see that or worse.
I'd rather have a bunch of people buy some 1% bonds and see that, wouldn't you?
Well, no, but because it ends in the same place.
Maybe, yeah, maybe.
What? Now, wait a minute.
I haven't thought it through totally. That's why I ran it by.
No. It ends in the same place, and here's why. If I buy 1% bonds, but the government is running a 7% fiscal deficit, I'm losing 6% a year.
Well, part and parcel would be they would at least cut out the interest part of their expansion.
That's not where the problem's coming
right,
from.
Well, it's getting there.
Well, I get that. Yeah. And that has to stop.
Yeah, well, okay? How's it going to stop?
But the thing is, what you're not coupling this with, Chief, is the problem stopping.
Well, okay? I'm trying to couple as much as I can. It's kind of a big subject.
Well, no, the only way you can stop it is to stop the deficit
I get
spending.
That.
Well, and that means taking the people within the CMS adjacent stuff, which is the entire medical system, dragging them out by the curlies, holding the sack in their hand and taking a knife to it. That has to happen.
The only thing we're disagreeing on here, we got a dash. The only thing we're disagreeing on is where we are, where we think we are in the cycle. I think, I mean, right now our interest is $1.0 trillion a year. Medicare is $1.9 trillion. You're right.
It's 2.1 last fiscal.
All right, I'm looking at the debt clock
all of
here.
CMS. Okay, on the MTS, all of CMS is a little over two.
I'm with you. You've got it. I'm saying right now, if all of a sudden, let's just say.
Well, by the way, that's not all of it because Medicaid's a 50-50 match.
So the
other half's the states.
Well, okay, but I'm saying my only point here, and again, we got to run, is if all Carl's stuff, and I'll use you in the third person, all Carl's stuff happened today, and all of a sudden we were balanced. The hospitals start charging less for fear of going to jail or getting their head lopped off or something. Everybody starts doing what they're supposed to do tomorrow. I think the interest numbers right now are so big, we're kind of past. In other words, I think we have a problem now, even if tomorrow the budget was balanced. Solomon comes down from the clouds, kicks Trump out of there, and Solomon somehow balances everything tomorrow. I still think we got a problem.
Well, you got a problem, but here's the thing. The forward expectation, if you did that and you actually fixed it, the forward expectation now is the operating fiscal deficit of the government is going to be the interest payments for the time being.
Yeah.
All right. And therefore, that's 2%. By the way, the IRX is at 3.6, which means there's now a forward gain on those bonds. Okay. By the way, that means they get paid off. Over time, not tomorrow, but over time. And the thing is that, and so no, the curve doesn't go batshit crazy. What ends up happening there is you see the curve basically stabilize at a forward upward sloping rate.
All right, the only thing we're disagreeing on, you don't think we're there yet. I think we might be.
Well, I think we are.
At some point, if you got a leak in your basement, you're drowning. Even if you stop the leak, it's too high already.
Well, I don't think that we are beyond the point of no return, but we're awfully close.
That's what I'm saying. We're getting pretty close. We're just debating.
Yes, and the reason, Chief, is because all exponential curves ultimately do the same thing. They go straight up. Okay, and if you don't cut it out when that starts happening, you're doomed.
Weren't the Republicans supposed to be the conservative fiscal people?
Well, you know what? It doesn't make any difference who I vote for anymore. And this is one of the reasons I believe that there is a very high probability that there isn't a peaceful solution to this, and the other answers are going to be the ones we get. Oh. Because it doesn't matter who you vote for. Okay, Obama, for all the people, there were things that he did that I liked. But between the Affordable Care Act and what he did with federalizing student debt, that man was responsible for more of this damage one president than anyone in American history, other than perhaps Lincoln, and he got shot.
I'm going to say, last utterance here, I promise. Bush doubled the deficit when he was in office. Obama doubled the deficit when he was in office.
Yeah.
Trump was on his way to first term. Biden was on his way. Now, COVID was part of that, so you got to give those guys a break there. And now Trump's clearly well beyond that now. So you go back. Everybody since Clinton has at least doubled the deficit during their term.
I understand that. But
not deficit, the debt.
No, I understand that, Chief. But what I'm talking about is structural changes in the way finance is done in the United States that are very difficult to reverse. I'm not talking about spending bills passing in Congress. You are absolutely correct on that, okay? I'm talking about structural changes. We have a negative ROI on most degree programs in education today.
Well, if socialism is so bad, how come Sweden can balance their budget and we can't?
Well, because Sweden doesn't do this sort of crap.
Well, okay.
And by the way, you pay a very high rate of taxes, but you actually get services. They don't get stolen.
They don't get stolen.
we steal them. You don't get services back for your money here.
If we had to do it again, instead of saying the United States, the United States of kleptocracy or something. Anyway, S&P futures down 89. NASDAQ futures down 511. What do you like tonight? What do you like in the series? Sox on a streak and Cubs a good team. This would be a good weekend.
Oh, you know, it actually might not be bad at all, huh?
I bet it'd be tough to get a ticket tonight down at Sox Park.
By the way, I have a ticket for the Bananas here in Knoxville next weekend.
I'm going to go take a ride and go see the Joliet Jackhammers play someday.
And you know what? That's like Harlem Globetrotters with baseball, though.
Oh, God.
I mean, it's basically what it is. It's they call it banana ball. It's not even called baseball.
SP futures down 89. NASDAQ futures down 510. 30-year bonds, 5.1, up 1.8%. 10-year up 2.2%.
Here we go.
We're on our road here. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jacks.
that's all, folks.